Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Pretty much a single topic today, but it's a big one. More on energy and climate policy. First, in a few minutes, we'll hear from Tyson Slocum, a public citizen, on the outlook from D.C. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll hear from Lucia Green Weisko on the Cancun climate talks and Chinese environmental policy. First, a few words in the news. Time is short today, so just a quick look at the December employment report. Employers added 103,000 jobs in December, considerably less than economists who follow these things were expecting. 100,000 is better than nothing, but it's still well under half the long-term average and well below what we need to get the labor market back to some semblance of health. That gain, plus some upward revisions to estimates for the previous 2 months, now takes employment back to where it was when the recession ended a year and a half ago. Yes, you heard that right. We lost 1 million jobs in the second half of 2009 after the official end of the Great Recession, and we didn't start gaining them until January of this year. But the gains were so weak that it's taken us the entire year to make up late 2009's losses. As what now seems like usual, just over half the private sector gain came from two sectors, healthcare and bars and restaurants. Another quarter came from temp and retail. Amusements, gambling, and recreation also showed a good gain. For a while, I've been describing this as the eat, drink, and get sick economy. Now it looks like I'll have to add gamble to the mix. Manufacturing showed a nice gain, continuing a year of strong performance in that important but very battered sector. Construction continues to decline, and the fiscal crisis showed its fangs as local government employment took a sharp hit. Average hourly earnings for all workers were up just 0.1% for the month, not enough even to keep up with inflation. Wage growth is now in a 2-year slowdown. The numbers I've been quoting came from the Bureau of Labor Statistics survey of some 300,000 employers. Its simultaneous survey of 60,000 households looked somewhat stronger. The household survey did show some strong employment gains. Sometimes this survey is noisy, and strong gains in 1 month can be reversed in the next, but sometimes it picks up turns in the job market before the employer survey does. So we'll have to watch next month's numbers to get a better idea of whether this is news or noise. The unemployment rate fell by a sharp 0.4 point to 9.4%, its lowest level since May 2009. Some of that came from labor force withdrawal, as people just dropped out of the labor force or didn't bother to enter it, but there was also a sharp decline in the rate of job loss. The broader measure of unemployment, the so-called U6 rate, which accounts for people who want full-time work but who can only find part-time, and also for those who've given up the job search as hopeless, fell by 0.3 point to 16.7%. It's going in the right direction, but it remains painfully high. While it was good to see manufacturing extend its gains over the last year, you do have to wonder about the longevity of the eat, drink, gamble, and get sick model for the U.S. economy. And as strong as some of the household measures were, there's no reason to think that we've left the frustratingly torpid pace of the post-financial crisis labor market recovery behind us. A lot of Wall Street cheerleaders are looking for an acceleration in job growth this spring and summer, but I'll believe that when I see it. The economy remains sick, and the job market may be its sickest feature. A couple of weeks ago, I promised a turn-of-the-year thumbsucker, but holiday madness led me to another rerun last week, so there was no thumbsucker. It's getting a bit late for New Year punditry, so it's no longer really appropriate. If I'd done this last week, I'd have said something about how little our political discourse has changed, despite the worst economic crisis of the last 8 decades. And now that the new Congress has taken office, we've taken several steps backward. With Yahoo's now in the ascendancy, I fear that we're going to hear now about how important it is to replace Republicans with Democrats, as if the awfulness of the Dems had nothing to do with the Republican victory. I hope this is the year that we can start getting beyond this yo-yoing binary, but I'm not sure why I should be hopeful. Still, I'll keep these doubts on ice until March. Okay, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk energy. was a bit of the second movement of Haydn's Piano Sonata No. 34, performed by Yeno Yondo. Now, Tyson Slocum. Tyson Slocum directs the energy program at the D.C.-based Public Citizen. With an old Congress that was weak on energy and climate policy now replaced by one that's insane on energy and climate policy, I thought I'd check in with Tyson to see what the lay of the land is down in the imperial capital. Tyson Slocum. Welcome, Tyson. Before we talk about the new configuration of power in Washington, let's talk a bit about energy prices. What are your thoughts on why the oil price is closing in on $100 now?
Well, I think it's a combination of our continued reliance on a finite fossil fuel to power our economy, growing demand in countries like China, even though it's growth estimates are actually smaller than projected. It has to do with financial speculation. Wall Street banks that created the largest financial crisis in history due to their risky operations in unregulated derivatives markets, those rules have not yet been fundamentally changed. And so we're still seeing these Wall Street speculators play a significant role driving prices beyond the supply-demand fundamentals. And I think also the lack of viable alternatives to folks driving around in their gasoline-powered vehicles. We have not invested enough in the electrification of our transportation sector, in making electric hybrid vehicles and other cleaner vehicles more widely available to working families. We have not invested enough in mass transit. And so while a lot of people do point to Americans' gluttonous ways in terms of driving fuel-inefficient vehicles, there are some things that are really beyond the control of a lot of working families. For a lot of folks, the only house that they and their family could afford was in the suburbs where property values were lower. The only car that they can afford is a used car, and the used car market is less fuel efficient than the new car market. And so we need to think more holistically about how we're going to create smarter growth and smarter cities in terms of a more sustainable transportation sector. And so none of this can be solved in one Congress, but it's imperative that we start laying the framework down to get ourselves off of oil and get into a more sustainable, sane transportation policy in this country.
Yeah, we had a period of very high oil prices, 2005, 2006, and then a recession. And these things together did depress oil demand. But now that the economy is recovering, sort of, it seems like it's almost like we're back where we started. Oil demand rising, prices rising. The prices are almost looking like we're in the midst of an economic boom.
Right. And you know, U.S. demand hasn't really been increasing. You know, people are not pointing to growing U.S. demand. They're saying there is the potential for growth in demand if the economy starts picking up more. And so we saw oil prices respond not to the BP oil spill and the resulting moratorium on drilling, but more to the Fed's policy of, you know, releasing a ton of money in the hopes of stimulating the economy. And that's what sent traders pushing the price of crude oil up. The irony is that these high energy prices, if they're sustained, could kill economic growth. So we saw that in the summer of 2008 when oil prices hit an all-time high of $147 a barrel. We had a national average of $4 a gallon for gasoline, and that was the tipping point. We saw demand significantly drop off in the U.S., but it came at a price. You know, it's akin to driving a nail in the wall with a sledgehammer. You know, significantly rising prices in energy products will result in lower demand, but there's a lot of collateral damage that occurs, particularly for folks living at the margins, for working families that lack any real access to alternatives to those high prices.
Yeah, you sort of anticipated my next question, which is, are high prices enough, really, to catalyze a shift towards the more sensible forms of energy you were talking about earlier, or does policy have to push it in that direction?
Yeah, I think policy has to push in that direction by complementing, say, we pursue a carbon price to address climate change, to decentivize carbon-intensive fuels like coal and oil in order to incentivize zero-carbon fuels like renewables, you know, that's going to result in higher prices. And so you've got to have set-aside investment available to working folks to help them arm themselves with more tools to become more energy efficient, to weatherize their homes, to be able to afford to buy that hybrid car, to give more resources to municipal and county mass transit systems so that we can expand routes and maybe even reduce fares. There's a lot of things that need to happen outside of just rising energy prices. Now, I'm not saying that Americans should be entitled to the cheap fuel and to a dollar a gallon gas. There's legitimate reasons that we're paying higher prices than we did in the 1990s. There's climate reasons that we shouldn't be addicted to cheap energy, but we have failed to make the fundamental investments in smart growth, in sustainability, in transportation alternatives, in renewable energy deployment that we really need to protect working families from the kind of price spikes that we're currently facing.
Before we talk about the new Congress, let's talk for a moment or two about the Congress that just went out of existence. It was impossible to get through even a very mild cap-and-trade bill through the last Congress. First of all, what was your analysis of that bill? But second of all, why couldn't they even get that through before we start talking about the next couple of years?
Right. Well, I think your description of the bill is accurate in that it was mild. It was questionable whether or not that House bill, the Waxman-Markey bill that passed in the summer of 2009, would have been effective at reducing greenhouse gas emissions. I think that the debate on climate change in the U.S. Congress failed to register with the American people because the American people were never at the center of it. All of the negotiations, all of the more than 1,000 pages of that complex piece of legislation was developed by congressional staff working closely with inside the Beltway industry lobbyists and a handful of large corporate-affiliated environmental groups. And it shouldn't have been a mystery that when you legislate on the cheap by simply reaching out to all the corporate lobbyists that you know in Washington, D.C. and say, what do you need to see in a climate bill? American families are going to get left outside that. And so there was nothing that was a convincing sell to the American people that they were going to benefit from this, because they weren't. The folks that were going to benefit were powerful energy companies that all cut their side deals. So if we're going to address climate change, which we need to, we can no longer afford to have energy corporations dictate the terms of the debate. We've got to put forward a climate bill that provides some tangible benefit to working families, and that bill is something that Public Citizen helped work on. It's called Cap and Dividend, and it's where emissions are capped at a maximum allowable amount per year. Fossil fuel producers and importers have to pay to get a permit to emit carbon dioxide, and they have to buy that permit from the government. And so the government collects billions and billions of dollars in revenues, which it can then use to directly reimburse families for, you know, to offset the increase in energy prices from the effect of the carbon-like tax, with a ton of money left over to invest in renewable energy research and development and deployment. So I think when you put together a climate bill that essentially prices carbon, you've got to have a component that kicks at least a healthy chunk of the money back to families in the form of a monthly check or a payroll tax deduction, however you want to structure it, so that you sell the American people on the concept of pricing carbon by cutting them in on the financial loop. And then, you know, you can gradually raise prices over time. You can gradually be more aggressive in deployment of renewables and other less carbon-intensive energy sources. That is the path forward, I think, that could help inspire people. I mean, that's what Barack Obama campaigned on in the 2008 election was cap and dividend. And it was promptly abandoned because of inside the Beltway horse trading. So that's our analysis of why efforts to address climate change fail. And of course, you know, you've got a sizable minority in the U.S. Congress, you know, led by cheerleaders like Fox News and Glenn Beck, that climate science is a fraud, that climate change isn't something that we need to worry about. You've got, you know, Koch Industries, a privately held company that has financed a lot of anti-science advocacy and lobbying. It's an oil company and a paper company. And so you've got vested interests that have opposed bringing the United States energy policy into 21st century sanity.
I'll speak with Tyson Slocum, who directs energy policy at Public Citizen in Washington. Okay, so let's talk a bit about this new cast of characters. As you say, many of them are climate skeptics. I think some of them even use the Bible as their script for explaining why there is no reason to worry about climate change. Give us the rundown. Who are the important personages in the new House?
Well, one of the most important is going to be Fred Upton from Michigan, who's going to be the new chairman of the House Energy and Commerce Committee. This is a very powerful committee with sweeping authority. He actually was more of a moderate as a Republican on the Energy and Commerce Committee, not a progressive by any means, but he was a guy that had acknowledged climate change in the past. But as the campaign to become chairman of this powerful committee heated up, he faced a stiff challenge from a term-limited former chairman, Joe Barton from Texas, who ran a kind of a dirty campaign, basically calling Fred Upton too liberal. And so Fred Upton, in order to win the chairmanship, took a hard right turn. And I think he's going to have to remain there if he wants to build support within his committee. So Fred Upton is one of these guys. He's not one of the worst, a John Shimkus from Illinois is one member of Congress who's going to be a powerful member of the Energy and Commerce Committee as well, who has actively cited the Bible in erroneously claiming that climate change couldn't happen because under his interpretation of the Bible, God wouldn't allow it.
Is he the fellow who said that God promised Noah that he wouldn't flood the earth again, therefore we have nothing to worry about?
That's correct. So it's unfortunate that in the year 2011, we have powerful members of Congress in the United States who, rather than listening to peer-reviewed science and the facts on the ground, are instead relying on the Bible to be their legislator. And that's a very dangerous position for us to be in, because the United States really cannot afford to lose competitive advantage to some of our economic competitors like China, who are now out investing the United States 2-1 on clean energy investment. So we've got to understand that the future of energy policy will not be coal and oil. It has to be renewable energy. And we are losing that race because the vested fossil fuel industry, the ExxonMobils of the world, the Peabody Coals, the Massey Energies, they are succeeding in influencing members of Congress and controlling the terms of the debate, and that's really unfortunate.
Now, I can see how certainly the oil and coal industries would want to buy some congressmen to defend their interests, but there's many business interests who could make money on alternative energy development, clean technologies. Why are they so underrepresented in Washington, and why is the power of the fossil fuel lobby seemingly so overrepresented?
I think it has to do with the fact that these are smaller industries. They're not as well market capitalized. When you look at just the petroleum industry, they've got $1 trillion of assets locked into pulling oil and natural gas out of the ground, refining it, and selling it to the American people. And that's a very lucrative business, especially with oil at $92, $93 a barrel. The last thing these companies want to do is to start seeing real viable alternatives emerge that would reduce the value of their $1 trillion of sunk capital. So from a pure business standpoint, if you're an oil company, you want to squeeze every last penny of profit out of your sunk capital before you allow alternatives to gain a real foothold. And so you are going to lobby aggressively on that interest. And that's really the bottom line here, is that the renewables, even though cost estimates for new solar photovoltaic cells plummet every quarter, they're becoming more and more efficient and less expensive. They can empower communities by decentralizing power sources so that our buildings could become power generators, but they do not have the market capitalization. They don't have the influence because they're not major players in our industrial economy yet, the way that the petroleum and coal sectors are.
The EPA currently has power to regulate carbon emissions, but there are a lot of Republicans who would like to take that away from them. What do you see happening in that area? Are they going to succeed at that?
Well, they very well might. Right now, it appears as though with the new members of the Senate arriving this session, that it appears as though there are at least 60 senators who would vote to delay the EPA's ability to implement greenhouse gas regulations for another 2 years or so. So the question is how aggressively the Obama administration is going to defend its authority, whether or not he would veto efforts to put in an appropriations bill or other type of format that would deny the EPA the ability to regulate greenhouse gases. And we have to remember, this wasn't some sort of Democrat or socialist conspiracy by Obama's EPA. This was a Supreme Court decision in 2007, a Supreme Court that was dominated by conservatives, by pro-industry justices that ruled that the EPA has the clear authority under the Clean Air Act, which was originally passed back in 1970, to regulate greenhouse gases. So this was a conservative Supreme Court that ruled during the Bush administration that the federal government had the authority and the obligation to regulate greenhouse gases. So Republicans need to understand, or opponents of EPA authority need to understand, that Congress authorized this, that climate change is real, that it's verified by the science, and that the EPA is taking modest steps to try to protect the American public and the climate by implementing common sense rules to reduce greenhouse gases.
How hard did the administration fight on the Markey-Waxman bill? Certainly far from perfect. It was probably better than nothing, but did they push hard for it, or did they just hang back?
They definitely, I think, put a moderate effort into selling that bill. You could go back and find a lot of very supportive statements by the Obama administration, by Carol Browner, his climate czar, and Stephen Chu, the Secretary of Energy, that talked glowingly about the bill. But there were some who believed that he never really threw his weight behind it. So I think that he understood that the way that Congress was crafting climate legislation, that it wasn't going to be a winning political issue. You know, Obama, as a centerpiece to his successful presidential campaign, campaigned on a aggressive climate bill that would price carbon, and that the government would collect all the money from pricing carbon, and that 80% of that money would immediately be refunded back to people in the form of a making work pay tax credit. So Obama understood during the campaign how to talk to the American public about rallying behind climate change. he unfortunately delegated too much to his congressional allies, who came up with a inferior, flawed plan.
And given that precedent, how do you think he's going to stand up to the Yahoos or gain the upper hand in Congress now?
Well, I think that remains to be seen. I think that there's a lot of groups, including ours, that are going to continue to put the pressure on the administration to stand up for aggressive and meaningful action on climate change. And that means issuing veto threats against any congressional action that would deny funding to the EPA for it to carry out its job as authorized by the United States Supreme Court to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. So it's also going to be up to the listeners out there who need to call their members of Congress and call the White House to ensure that our elected officials are hearing from their constituents about how important climate change is. Because we all know that the coal companies, the oil companies, they're talking to our elected officials every day. They're giving money through their political action committees to their reelection campaigns. So it's up to the American people to try to combat the insidious influence of special interest money in our democracy.
I was Tyson Slocum, director of the energy program at the D.C.-based Public Citizen. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back with more energy and climate after a musical break.
I know Jesus is on that main line. Tell him what you want. Jesus on that main line. Tell him what you want. Jesus on that main line. Tell him what you want. Call him up and tell him what you want.
Since we've now got a bunch of Congress people who look to the Bible for guidance on climate policy, I thought a word about Jesus might be in order. That was Ry Cooter doing Jesus on the Mainline from his 1974 album Paradise and Lunch. Next up, Lucia Green Weiskel. Lucia is project manager of the Climate Change Program at the Beijing-based Innovation Center for Energy and Transportation. Although the NGO is based in China, Lucia is based in Brooklyn, in the next neighborhood over from mine. She has a piece on the Cancun climate negotiations in the January 3rd issue of The Nation. Unlike a lot of the stuff you see and hear in our media, which bellows ignorantly about China, Lucia knows and understands that country and how to talk to Americans about it. Lucia Green Weiskel. Welcome, Lucia. It must be a little surreal to talk about climate crisis in Cancun. What was it like to be there?
Thanks, Doug. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me on the show. It was an odd venue for the negotiations. First of all, the resorts are completely oblivious to any sort of environmental sensitivities, and anybody who works in oceans or marine life knows that the lights from the resorts are very disruptive to the ocean life there. And of course, none of that was talked about, and even in my hotel, there wasn't recycling and it just seemed like there was a real lack of environmental awareness in the conference itself. And I think in comparison to Copenhagen, that was a real change, because Copenhagen really did make a big effort to have offsets for people traveling to the event, and there's some sort of awareness of that.
How much of a change has there been between the Bush and Obama administrations? Anything like one might have expected from the campaign rhetoric?
Well, the Obama administration has been really interesting on China, and actually just yesterday I read an article that there's going to be a big mix-up or a big shift in the key people in his National Security Council and also the State Department on Asia policy. And the Washington Post, I think, had an article that said that Obama wanted to hit the reset button on U.S.-China relations, which is really interesting because up until this point, it hasn't really been talked about as a problem. You know, Obama hasn't really talked about his China policy, or people haven't really criticized Obama's China policy as being problematic. So it's interesting that he wants to hit the reset button. It makes you wonder, well, what was wrong? And now where is it going? You know, is it going to be more hawkish, or is it going to be more accommodating to China? I think Obama hasn't really played, you know, hasn't really focused on China that much. He's been dealing with two big wars and huge domestic problems. And his link to China has been through the jobs issue. So he hasn't really been able to have a full perspective of, you know, how the U.S.-China can cooperate, work together on things like green technology, which is what a lot of people are pushing Obama to do. But there's this upcoming summit on January 19th. Hu Jintao is making his first visit to Washington, and it's being talked about as a really big issue with energy high on the agenda, and the announcement of the U.S.-China Clean Energy Research Center by Secretary Stephen Chu, I think, will be a big part of Obama's China policy on energy.
How are the Chinese viewing the U.S. these days? Their economy is booming, ours is stumbling, we owe them $1 trillion. We used to like to lecture them all the time on how to do things. Now do they feel like turning the tables and lecturing us?
Yeah, well, I'll make a distinction between the Chinese government and then sort of the people that I have spent time with, and you know, kind of the, if I can speak for the sort of average Chinese voice or an average Beijing or something. I don't know if there's a feeling of wanting to lecture the U.S., but there is a little bit of smugness that's developed, and I think with good reason, especially this sort of starting after the Olympics, when the Chinese government invested huge amounts of money into infrastructure, and Beijing basically catapulted from a city that had many functional problems to one that is absolutely, you know, loaded with skyscrapers, is just, you know, square footage of these modern buildings just being tossed up into the air at this incredible rate, and this high-speed trains linking Beijing to the surrounding cities. And then China's been the host of Shanghai was the host of the Expo, and so that also saw a similar spike in very modern development. And so a lot of people in China feel very proud of that development. Thomas Friedman wrote a recent op-ed that was basically what WikiLeaks would have covered if it was covering a Chinese a consular embassy in the United States. And it's really funny, and it's about how these Chinese people are talking about how the United States is really behind in all these areas, but they don't even know they're behind because they never leave the country to find out and sort of get any comparison or perspective. And they talk about how they're in Africa, their embassies, when they take trains, their cell phones don't drop calls, but in Washington, D.C., when they take the Acela, which goes really slow, and, you know, the call gets dropped like 6 times or something like that. And I sent it to a bunch of my Chinese friends, and I was like, well, what do you think? Is Thomas Friedman, is this accurate? Is he presenting a Chinese view? And the answer was resoundingly yes, that this is kind of the Chinese perspective. That the U.S. is just really falling behind in all these technical areas, and just really, and is caught up in these political fighting. I mean, the you know, China has for a long time kind of looked at the U.S. political process and been like, you know, why are you spending all this money on ads? And you're obviously just in supporting corporate interests, and then just squabbling in Congress and not really able to get anything done, and feeling a little bit smug about their system working much faster and better. But of course, you know, China has massive, massive problems in implementation. So I think there are some legitimate points, but you can't really compare the two systems in that way.
Okay, now on to climate. The U.S. and China are very important parts of any of these sorts of negotiations. Together, the two countries are responsible for about a third of global output, and more than that of global greenhouse emissions. How do they get along in Cancun compared to earlier years?
Well, better. This was kind of a breakthrough for China. I think in the last year since Copenhagen, China learned how to negotiate. It sort of understood the process in a new way, and really grew up and became a more mature negotiator. In Copenhagen and then in Tianjin at the intersessional meeting, there was a lot of hostility between the Chinese negotiators and the U.S. counterparts, including things like, you know, specific Chinese negotiators wagging their fingers and saying nasty things, and calling the Americans names, like a pig preening itself in the mirror. That's what the Chinese called the American negotiators. And this time in Cancun, I think there's much more civil behavior between the two. But also in their position, I think China has realized that it can very effectively put out offers and then, you know, be the positive voice instead of being the one who's saying no, no, no to everything. That China can, you know, speak first and say, this is what we want to have happen. You know, we want to see a positive outcome. And then putting the pressure on the United States for the first time. And last year, it was really the United States putting pressure on China and China feeling backed into a corner. So the tactics have changed, but they're... The Chinese position has essentially remained the same. And it was funny in Cancun watching some of the press come out, some of the stories come out. People thought that there were these huge breakthroughs. One, for example, there was a couple of articles saying that China was for the first time willing to submit its domestic mitigation actions as part of a binding treaty. But then if you look very closely back at what the Chinese actually said that they would do that only if the United States also agreed to binding targets, which at the time was completely ridiculous without legislation passed in the U.S. Senate. There's no way that the U.S. could have signed on to any agreement with binding targets. So they were basically saying, you know, we will do this, but it was conditional on this impossible event. But somehow the press sort of missed that and thought this was this big breakthrough. And then the other issue was on MRV, measuring, reporting, and verification, which is the process by which you can make sure that a ton of carbon is equal all around the world. It's kind of the methodology. And that's been a real sticking point between the U.S. and China.
Reading your piece of The Nation, I was struck by how much these negotiations sound like the old arms control talks during the Cold War. Trust but verify, as Reagan liked to say.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it really is. I mean, these are these details, and most people who don't study this issue, their eyes glaze over when you talk about how to measure, report, and verify carbon emissions. I mean, it's a very abstract concept, but it's in the details where the specifics lie, and this is sort of, so it makes sense that this would be where the squabbling is, because this is actually what's really important. This is where, depending on how MRV is implemented, China can either completely ignore its responsibilities or will be, you know, very much pinned down by serious regulations. So it's a very important issue. But in the very beginning of the Cancun conference, Su Wei, who's the second in command of the Chinese team, said that China was fine with MRV. And everyone was shocked because that was an apparent reversal from the Copenhagen position, which was that MRV represented a breach of sovereignty and that China was very resistant to having this process be, you know, superimposed onto the Chinese. They wanted their own domestic approach to measuring, reporting, and verification, not the UN approach. But when they said that, they were really talking about a different type of MRV, and this is what I wrote about in the Nation article. It was basically how one concept is interpreted completely differently, and so what appears to be a coming together of opinions is really not at all that. And that's kind of, I think, you know, sadly where we ended at the end of the Cancun conference was the U.S. and China coming to some sort of rhetorical agreement that seemed like it was going somewhere. But when you really look closer, there's still a huge gap between the two.
A lot of Chinese emissions are the result of manufacturing stuff for export to the U.S. and other countries. How, if at all, is this accounted for in allocating the responsibility of reducing carbon emissions?
Yeah, well, it's not really accounted for. And by a few independent studies, one done by a guy named Wang Tao at Sussex University, a quarter of China's total annual emissions can be directly sourced to products that are made for export markets. The Chinese government for a while did talk about that. It's called carbon leakage. It's a problem all over the world. Any country that's producing carbon, a disproportionate amount of carbon-intensive goods, mostly the countries in the developing world, have this problem. We hear politicians in the United States talk about losing jobs overseas, but we never hear the fact that those jobs, the factories in which those jobs take place, also go overseas, and as does their pollution. This is a huge issue for China. I think, you know, a quarter of its annual emissions is bigger than all the emissions of Russia combined. So it's a huge amount. And also, China is now becoming a leader in green technology, wind turbines and solar panels. And that process, the process of manufacturing green technology in and of itself, is also very carbon intensive. And so, you know, China's carbon footprint is getting wider, larger, as it's contributing to the world's ability to rely on more renewable energy. So this is all very problematic, and it presents a problem, but it really isn't dealt with at the level of the United Nations or bilaterally between the United States and China, because it's just simply too much of a mess from a methodology point of view to figure out how to measure this and who's responsible for what carbon. So we just measure carbon now as, you know, how much is emitted in within the national boundaries of any specific country. But China has I think, taken this concept and turned it into, latched onto another concept that's in the Kyoto Protocol, which is the Common but Differentiated Responsibilities Clause. And that basically means this is sort of a more politically palatable way of talking about the same issue, sort of, not exactly, but kind of. And I think China has latched itself onto this because it knows that it can never deal with a carbon leakage issue directly. It's just not going to work politically. But carbon, the Common but Differentiated Responsibilities Clause basically says, this is written to the Kyoto Protocol in 1997, and it says that all countries have a common responsibility to deal with climate change, but they will mitigate their emissions based on the ability that they're able to, so based on the level of development of their economy. So China, as a developing country, doesn't have to commit to binding reductions under this clause. And that was what the Kyoto Protocol was all about. It was about dividing the world into Annex 1, developed countries, and Annex 2, developing countries, and saying everybody needs to deal with this problem, but to different extents, depending on how rich you are. And developing countries really liked that. The U.S. hated it, didn't sign on to the Kyoto Protocol primarily for that reason, and is now bringing this issue back front and center in Copenhagen and now again in Cancun by trying to scrap the Kyoto Protocol altogether and start over with a new agreement. The word used by Jonathan Pershing, who was the second-in-command negotiator for the U.S. team in Cancun, is synergy, so having equal commitments from both the developed and the developing world. He sees that as a policy that reflects synergy between developing and developing countries. This conflict between the U.S. and China, and indeed between the U.S. and all developing countries, or most developing countries, is still at large and really hasn't been dealt with. And even in the Cancun agreements, the final document that was produced by the COP16, the issue of the Kyoto Protocol, and specifically that Common but Differentiated Responsibility Clause, has been postponed to next year in South Africa. So, you know, they just didn't deal with it. It was just too messy.
I'm speaking with Lucia Green Weiskill, who is the project manager of the climate change program at the Beijing-based Innovation Center for Energy and Transportation. I do want to talk about Chinese environmental policy, but before we get there, this whole UN framework for climate negotiations seems hopelessly contradictory and painfully slow. Is there any hope for it? Can these periodic negotiations deliver us from climate catastrophe?
Well, I think it needs to be, and a lot of people are expressing similar doubt and concern. I mean, one of the main sentiments that came out of the Cancun agreements was that it was a very modest document, and one of its main purposes was to just salvage the process in and of itself. So, you know, if no agreement was struck in Cancun, it just was it just was going so badly. Why do we even have the UNFCCC at all? Why not just, you know, forget this and sort of toss the issue of climate change to other bodies, more elite bodies like the G20, or, you know, there's all these new groups that are emerging now, the R20, which is the regional group of 20 that was initiated by Governor Schwarzenegger. He's now not the governor anymore, but this is sort of his post-governor project, is this R20, and it includes regions in Indonesia and Europe and Canada, and it's an effort to have, you know, regional governments deal with the climate change issue. So I think a lot of people are expressing that sentiment that the UN just isn't pushing through. But at the same time, you know, we really need heads of states to make commitments. We really need these binding targets, and it's been the U.S. that's been standing in the way. So, you know, I would answer the UN system will work to the extent that its most powerful member will cooperate, and that's the United States. So if the U.S. passes legislation on climate change that's effective and meaningful, you know, I think the UN process can start rolling again. But it really can't. there is a chance that maybe next year in Durban, South Africa, at the COP17, something like the Kyoto Protocol will happen again, which is an agreement without the U.S. in Bali and at some of the other past COP meetings. People were saying things like, if the U.S. can't lead, it needs to just get out of the way completely. And so that may happen again. But, you know, people thought Obama was going to be different. He said he was going to be different. He was very clear about that. He said, you know, the time is now. I saw him speak in just after he was elected in November 2008, before he was inaugurated in California. He gave a speech and said, no issue, you know, I'm paraphrasing, but he said, there's no other issue that's more important than climate change, and now is the time, and the U.S. will be respected in the world again as a leader on climate change. I mean, I saw him say it, so it's kind of like, you know, it's really disappointing.
And now we've got people taking over in Congress who look to the Old Testament for guidance on climate policy.
Yes, right, exactly. And, you know, actually, I put together a little sort of timeline of kind of what the U.S., a lot of people talk about the U.S.-China, this green technology race, is this the new Sputnik moment? And that's kind of been a hot topic in the news. And so I've put together a timeline of kind of what the U.S. has been doing, what China has been doing blow by blow, and some interesting events, I mean, since the beginning of the new year. So just in the last couple of weeks, China has initiated demand-side management. So it's basically taxing utilities, the companies that are putting electricity into the grid, and then taking that money and investing in renewable energy. And then on the U.S. side, we have the new Republican-run House of Representatives, which closed the Committee on Global Warming. So we don't have that anymore. And then the first day of Congress, Republicans outlined three new bills to restrict the power of the EPA, which has been sort of the one victory that the Obama and the Democratic Congress have had, which is giving the EPA more power to regulate greenhouse gas emissions under the Clean Air Act. So, you know, so that's now being rolled back. And then again, we have China, which while we were in Cancun, actually the high-speed rail in between Beijing and Tianjin set a world record of going over 300 miles per hour. In the U.S., we have the Acela, you know, which goes, you know, not nearly that fast. I'm not even sure how fast. It's not even, you know, it gets in 20 minutes.
It tops out at 120.
120, but it also gets in, you know, usually it's like 20 minutes earlier than the, you know, than the regular train anyway. So there's this, you know, this whole series of kind of events where the U.S. is, you know, people think of the U.S. and China as neck and neck, but it looks like maybe they were neck and neck, but China is really making these quantum leaps forward, and the U.S. is making these quantum leaps in the, you know, backwards. The other thing is just, again, in 2011, China announced that by 2012, it's going to release its first nationwide greenhouse gas inventory. In order to do that, it needs to implement all these, you know, measures for measuring, reporting, and verification of greenhouse gases. So it's a pretty sophisticated, it requires a pretty sophisticated measuring process in order to be able to know how many tons of greenhouse gases are emitted from China. But they're planning on doing that by next year. And then also, China just passed its 12th five-year plan, which will be made public probably in English in this spring. The final version hasn't been released yet, but it includes a cap-and-trade program as well as carbon taxes. So, you know, China doesn't see cap-and-trade and carbon taxes as mutually exclusive as we do in the United States. They're doing both. You know, so it's pretty stunning. I mean, China may have a cap-and-trade system before the U.S. does, and it includes this new tax program and also subsidies for low-carbon technology and development, pretty massive subsidies. And I did a comparison of, you know, what it would cost to buy an electric vehicle in China and what it would cost in the United States. And, of course, you know, it's about half the price in China.
Speaking of subsidies, the United Steelworkers Union has filed a complaint with the U.S. Trade Representative alleging that Chinese subsidies to clean technologies are predatory and protectionist. The administration has agreed to investigate and possibly take this complaint to the World Trade Organization. It's like China can't do anything right. Either they're major environmental criminals or sinister trade manipulators. What do you make of this?
Yeah, I mean, I can see this from the political point of view, and it's really counterproductive because, China feels like it gets, you know, if it doesn't clean up its act environmentally speaking, then we slap these high carbon tariffs on imports coming from China. That's been a big fear from the Chinese government. But if they do take action and invest in renewable energy as they're doing and following this kind of Chinese style green or sustainable development that includes central planning and very aggressive government investment, then the unions and the U.S. Trade Representative are you know, screaming that this is illegal. And China has responded and said, you know, this is not illegal according to the WTO, and we'll have to wait and see how this plays out according to WTO rules. But it does look as if Obama is going to follow through with the investigation, and we'll just have to see who ends up winning this little dispute. But the point remains either way is that China just really feels that it's the scapegoat for so many different issues, and really not getting the support that it wants from the United States. That's a big problem. So I mean, I wrote an article about this, and I was suggesting, I don't know that much about the WTO, but I was saying, you know, I think subsidies, we need subsidies on both sides, you know, and I can see the U.S. steelworkers, I can see their point of view that it does feel unfair, but there's, maybe having subsidies on both sides would be the answer.
A common complaint is that, well, China may talk a good game on environmental policy. When you get down to the ground, they're not really walking the walk. What's really going on? How big a gap is there between rhetoric and reality?
Yeah, well, this is a big problem. There's been very ambitious regulations and policies that have been enacted at the central government level, but then when they get to the provincial level, there's so much corruption in provincial governments that companies can buy out their provincial leader and you know, do whatever they want in terms of their environment, disregard all these environmental regulations. And there's been a number of incidents where companies are given these different technologies to implement or to install in their factories to reduce the greenhouse gas emissions, but it's expensive and requires more in installation time or personnel, something like that, and basically they will, you know, have these gadgets, and then when the inspectors come along, they'll be using them, but then as soon as the inspectors leave, they turn them off. So there's been a number of stories that are kind of similar to that in China. But then also, and one really interesting thing, you know, China, there's a lot of people who can overly glamorize China, and I think there's a tendency to think of China as, you know, people either think of China as this really irresponsible, polluting country that has no control over its environmental development and is kind of going to, you know, destroy the entire planet. And then there are people who think that China is the beacon of hope, and that, you know, through this investment in green technology and, you know, lowering the price of green technology so it's accessible to the rest of the world, that China will save the world from climate change. But neither one of those is really true, and I think both need to, you know, we need to be cautious about the emergence of both of those opinions coming up in the U.S. media. But basically, so one example is that in the 11th five-year plan period, which was ended in 2009, China actually shut down some power plants in order to meet its energy reduction targets. So it experienced, there's wide parts of China that experienced blackouts in order to meet these targets. And that seemed really good. And I remember reading that thinking, wow, China's so dedicated to achieving its targets. It's really doing something about it. And then a couple weeks later, I found another article that said a lot of these factories that were being forced to close down to meet these regional targets were actually just buying diesel abroad, causing a diesel shortage, which is how I initially found that there was a diesel shortage. So then I started following that and learning more about it. And they were just running generators on diesel to keep their factories going. So, and all of that is off the record. So that's an example of you know, how these policies just aren't implemented. They may look like they are, and China may look like it's bending over backwards to reach these targets, but in fact, there's just not enough surveillance we just don't know enough about how to calculate the greenhouse gas emissions to know if it really results in a reduction.
So we're back to that thorny measurement problem.
Yeah, exactly.
That was Lucia Green Weiskill, project manager of the Climate Change Program at the Beijing-based Innovation Center for Energy and Transportation. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this remission of Burma's most recent album, not so new any longer, After the Rain. Rain is kind of climate-themed, right? Till next week. Bye.